Last week's feast of the baptism of the Lord marked a transition from Christmas season to ordinary time. We were fortunate here at the cathedral to celebrate baptisms on each of the Sunday masses, a great way to begin the new year. One of the definitions that I learned in seminary for a sacrament is one that sticks with me as a point of reference, one that's very helpful, baptism being the beginning of the sacramental life. And the definition is only a few words. It was from a great theologian of the last century who simply described sacraments as sensible bonds between two worlds. It's a fascinating way to think about the seven sacraments and the way that they speak the language of the senses. They engage our sight, our hearing, engage our taste, even if we think of the Eucharist, a sense of touch, and even smell if we think of sacred chrism and the fine aroma of that oil itself. It's also a way in which the sacraments are bonds between two worlds. It recalls in a way the image of the hourglass. I've heard this used before as an example, in which this narrow meeting place is uniting the two glass bulbs of an hourglass. Sacraments are operating in some ways in a similar fashion. In this narrow meeting place, heaven and earth, these two worlds are coming together. It's as if Christ is promising that in the sacraments, he will always meet us. As we shift to the second Sunday in ordinary time, we find connotations of another sacrament, the wedding feast of Cana. We find allusions to the sacrament of matrimony. As we think of the sacrament itself, this definition applies to it in a neat fashion. Marriage itself is a sensible bond between two worlds, man and woman, coming together as one. It also points, like all the other sacraments, to Christ himself, who is a marriage, the marriage of humanity and divinity in one person. So it's appropriate then, in a sense, that his first miracle in the Gospels is taking place at a wedding reception. I'd like to offer two little reflections on the gospel we hear today from John chapter 2. First is to acknowledge the presence of Mary. We're in a house of worship dedicated to Mary as patroness, so it's good not to forget her when she appears in the gospels. And today's is significant because it marks the last time recorded words of Mary appear in the gospels. She appears in later scenes, but she doesn't speak. This is the last time that we hear, and it's still very early in the Gospels. So she has two very straightforward phrases. The first is pretty obvious commentary on the situation. She says, they have no wine. What strikes me is that no one tells Mary that this is the case. It's not evident that other people know. Even Christ doesn't seem to know until Mary tells him. So what does it say about Mary then? If we picture this wedding scene, tells us a little bit that Mary quietly is very aware of what's happening. She's very pastorally sensitive to what could become a very embarrassing situation for this young couple to run out of wine. And Mary leads them to a solution, even though they don't know that she's working on a plan. It speaks in a small way to the fact that from the beginning of Christianity, countless men, women, and children have appealed to Mary times of need, struggle, hardship, looking for consolation. It tells us, in a good way, we can also turn there in times of need. The second phrase that Mary has is practically as short. She says five words, her last words in the Gospels, do whatever he tells you. It's a bit of an autobiography of Mary, a way of explaining her entire life. It's the pattern of her life, these words. And it's something that should become the pattern of the church itself in response to Christ. Second observation is a theme that is establishing early in the Gospels that reappears again and again. And it's that of superabundance, the grace of God overflowing. Think of these six stone jars. They're filled to the brim with 30 gallons of wine, 180, right? Not great at math, but we know that there's about that much, which is an astonishing amount of wine, let's face it. It doesn't even include the wine that would have been drunk already at the wedding. Superabundance, I've been to a lot of great wedding receptions, but this would be more than practically any wedding reception would need. It's not just enough, it's overflowing, which is a theme regarding the grace of God when we think about it. Another example is the multiplication of loaves. In some accounts, 5,000 are fed, in some, 4,000. In each case, Jesus begins with very little when it comes to loaves and fish, almost nothing, not even enough to feed the disciples. By the end of the miracle, superabundance. In some cases, in some accounts, 12 baskets of remains after this meal. Another passage of the many that stands out is John chapter 4, the Samaritan woman. You think of Jesus at the well with this woman, midday, it's just the two of them. This is what Jesus says to her. She's drawing water. John chapter 4, 13 to 14. Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I shall give will never thirst. The water I shall give will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. What sense can we make of the superabundance that comes with divine grace? One of the ways I would offer that we can think of it is to acknowledge that with every other appetite or desire of life, we're filled for a very short time, and then we become empty again, sometimes even emptier than before. But when it comes to the things of God, the life of God, the grace of God, we're not only filled to full, but we're filled to a type of superabundance, and we begin to overflow. The desire for God allows God to fill us with what God creates us for from the very beginning. It makes me think, finally, of a line that I received as a piece of advice when I went to seminary. I started back in 2003, which was a while ago. It surprises me how long ago now that was that I started this journey. When I went to seminary, I didn't really know what I was getting into, and I had been reading a lot of St. Therese, also known as the Little Flower. The Carmelites pray for priests. It's one of their charisms. So when I started, I wrote to a Carmelite community in Maryland, and I asked if a sister would pray for me. So I was assigned to a particular sister. I wrote her a letter, and at the end, I asked for advice. What would you give me? I'm just starting out. Not sure exactly where this is going to lead, what I'm into. So she writes me a letter back. She explains kind of who she is. She tells me her story. And at the end of the letter, she answers my question for advice. And this is the advice she gave me. Don't waste grace. There is so much of it at every moment. Which is great advice. Don't waste grace. There is so much of it at every moment. It speaks to the Christian life, struggles that we face. It speaks also, in a way, to this gospel from John chapter 2. Because there's a moment in which it seems in this gospel like the worst case scenario is about to happen. But then the very scene itself becomes the occasion for the glory of God to be revealed in an abundant way.